media. I mean, look, there have been pictures that have been broadcast, even on CNN. I got to say this. Excuse me. But even on CNN, pictures of children who are suffering from cerebral palsy or cystic fibrosis, not from hunger. And yet we're condemned for it. This has a long history of pointing the finger at the Jewish state and really has to stop.
So that was the Israeli ambassador speaking earlier. So, you know, the reference is to a New York Times cover story which showed the image of a child who appeared, in fact, was starving. But the Israelis said the story was misleading because the child actually had cerebral palsy. Now, Dr. Salimi, if you could explain, that argument, respond to what was said now, but also the fact that that child had cerebral palsy. But first of all, cerebral palsy patients don't necessarily look so enormously emaciated. And you know, the claims that Israel is making about what's actually going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that the government on one hand is saying one thing, and then in our experience, what we've seen firsthand as clinicians on the ground are seeing something completely different, that there is, widespread starvation caused by the siege. We see it every day. We see it in our patients and in children, not just with other conditions, but including cerebral palsy, they shouldn't be starving to death. So we have other children who don't have any other conditions who were also clearly starving from lack of nutritional food, and adults. And like I said, the caretakers that are supposed to be taking care of those who come in for care. I mean, how is this possible that they also are not getting nutritional food and starving and hungry?
And just to be clear, I mean, if you're suffering starvation and you get food, that doesn't mean you're going to be okay for the rest of your life. Can you talk about the effect of starvation on children, on adults?
Sure. Based on what I know, again, it's not my area of expertise, but we know that many adults and children right now are in a stage five of the famine and starvation, and reintroducing food to a body that's been starved for months has to be done very carefully. And it can actually lead to somebody dying if it's not done appropriately, because you have lack of not just food. I mean, you can eat bread every day, but that's not enough to sustain development, healthy, brain development, body development. And I think that's the thing that you'll see even in kids now after being deprived for months. The siege that's happening in the last few months is an acute event on top of a chronic, already malnourished population. So it's, insults to injury. And again, these long-term effects of, developmental delay for kids, we see that. We know that's a possibility. How is it going to affect the adults long-term when they do eventually get a steady supply of food? And I think that we know that there's going to be chronic health conditions.
You've also worked in Ukraine. We just have 30 seconds, but the comparisons.
I mean, they're both tragic situations. But one thing I'll say is I have worked in both, and as a humanitarian physician, feel that it's important that we work where we can, where the populations need it. But the one thing I can say for Gaza that is different is that there's no safe place in Gaza. We hear it all the time. Being there, it was absolutely, it was completely evident that there's no safe place in Gaza.
Dr. Ambreen Salimi, urogynecologist, executive director of the International Medical Response Foundation, just back this week from volunteering for several weeks at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Wednesday, Canada became the latest country to announce plans to recognize a Palestinian state, joining recent calls by France and the UK. Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke in Ottawa.
Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September 2025. This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state.
Israel blasted Canada's move, calling it a, quote, reward for Hamas. President Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, that will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them. He was referring to Canada. Meanwhile, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt and other Arab nations have joined a call for Hamas to disarm and end its rule in Gaza. The countries signed on to a joint call agreed to at a UN conference here in New York, co-hosted by Saudi Arabia and France, to build support for a two-state solution. For more, we're joined by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's in Copenhagen, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about these political developments, both the UK, France, Canada saying they're going to recognize Palestine as a state, and then Saudi Arabia, Egypt saying that Hamas has to disarm.
Absolutely. Thanks, Amy, for having me. The first thing to emphasize is that this is no way a reward for Hamas. It's actually, it proves hardliners within Hamas wrong when they say that nonviolence or advocacy do not work, diplomatic engagement is futile, and might makes right violence is the only way. When you give Palestinian moderates victory of this symbolic nature to argue with their hardline peers and say, look, there is an alternative path, this is in no way a reward for Hamas. What is actually a gift to hardliners is the Trump administration, literally about 5 minutes ago, imposing sanctions on Palestinian Authority officials, PLO officials, for trying to seek justice through the international court system, the Court of Justice and Criminal Court, and saying that this is a step too far. In terms of these promises of recognition, it's largely symbolic. It's filled with caveats, loopholes, and qualifiers and conditions. Countries are deferring it until September, and some countries are saying we would recognize if Israel does not end the genocide in Gaza by then. But even then, even with these hesitant small steps, Israelis are saying this is dealing a significant amount of pain to the Israeli government. Yeah, Barak Ravid, one of the most prominent Israeli journalists, was saying yesterday that this is the worst diplomatic defeat Israel has suffered since its creation. And it is for three reasons. Number one, it's because the two-state solution is a conversation Israel does not want to have at all, because once you begin to say, okay, let's move towards peace, Israel would see this as a peace offensive. That's literally a term that Israeli security strategist Avner Yaniv coined. And they would see it as a threat, because that conversation would expose and lay bare who is the rejectionist party. Now you have consensus in the Israeli mainstream, wall to wall, including the opposition parties that are saying, like Yair Golan, Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz, are saying there's not going to be any Palestinian state anytime soon. And you don't want to open that conversation, because it is going to show that Israel is the one that's rejecting it. Like, one of the reasons why Israel's propaganda is failing miserably, it's because Israel has gone too extreme, that it became a political suicide for any Israeli diplomat or politician to even fake support for peace and the two-state solution. They would lose their jobs immediately. And the second reason is because Israel is trying to sell a fantasy of ethnic cleansing in Gaza and in the West Bank as the ultimate solution to the Palestinian question. To tell the Trump administration that the most humane thing we can do to Palestinians is to kick them all out of Gaza and turn it into a Riviera. But when you have countries that are saying, look, here is a solid political track that can end this occupation, end Israel's apartheid, allow both sides to live in peace, and that political track is endorsed by every single Palestinian political party, including Hamas. Hamas said, we will dismantle our arms, we will dismantle ourselves, lay down our arms if Israel ends the occupation. If you try to say, no, there is this alternative plan, Israel would be threatened by that. That's when even like Emmanuel Macron, the French president, he said in Singapore a month ago, he was saying something like, we will recognize Palestine on these multiple conditions, Hamas disarming, Hamas leaving Gaza, Hamas not having any political future. Israel panicked and immediately attacked him and called it a crusade, because they see it as a threat. And the third fear is a snowballing effect. We see European governments that are saying recognition is not enough. It needs to be coupled with pressure on Israel, with sanctions, with penalizing measures to advance the Palestinian statehood to the end of the occupation. This morning, the Swedish prime minister, who is a right-wing coalition leader that is pro-Israeli for a very long time, was saying this morning, we need to impose these economic sanctions on Israel under the association agreement. So that's something that Israel is terrified of.
And so, Mohammed, you know, just to go back to the question of recognition, only to point out that the state of Palestine is recognized by 147 of the 193 UN member states. So, you know, if you could elaborate on, you know, the position that France, the UK and Canada have taken, the distinction between their position and the position the US is taking, because as you've pointed out, European governments have now moved from calling for the absolute destruction or dismantling of Hamas and Israel's right to do so, to calling on Hamas to hand over its weapons and ruling Gaza to the Palestinian Authority while leaving the door open for Hamas to join the PLO.
Absolutely, Nermeen, there's a significant shift here. European governments early on were saying Hamas needs to be dismantled, Hamas needs to be destroyed completely, and Israel has a right to do so. They now realized what the Trump administration has not come to realize yet. Trump and his team are still living in the fantasy that Hamas can be destroyed or it can be forced into surrendering. Whereas European governments are saying surrender is not going to happen, military defeat is not going to happen. The most extensive study in history on non-state armed actors was done by the Rand Corporation, I think in 2008, and they looked at groups like Hamas between the years 1968 until 2008, and they found that only 7% were defeated militarily, 43% through a political process. So that's why you see Western governments now saying that Hamas will not be forced into surrender, and Israel has failed to destroy Hamas militarily. The only way you can proceed forward is not a framework of capitulation, but one of decommissioning, like Northern Ireland, trying to get a process of Hamas disarming or laying down its arms hand in hand with a credible path towards Palestinian statehood. And that's what Israel sees as a threat, because Netanyahu is using it as a pretext to maintain an endless war in Gaza by saying we need to destroy Hamas while doing very close to nothing in that regard. They failed miserably. 22 months of unprecedented warfare in modern history since the Second World War, it did not defeat Hamas. But the pretext is still being used by the Israeli government, the Israeli military, to sustain the genocide in Gaza. So if you have countries that are offering them a way out, a way to climb down from the tree, a way to disarm Hamas, of course Israel and the U.S. will react very harshly and in a very hostile manner to this.
It's been very interesting to see Trump disassociate himself from Netanyahu's remarks that there's no starvation in Gaza. Trump said otherwise. He saw the pictures, he said, on TV. They look hungry, he said. As he uses tariffs to attack countries politically, like he wants to protect the Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's on trial for attempting a coup, and he's going to impose 50% tariffs on Brazil, and attacks other countries like Canada for saying they're going to recognize a Palestinian state. What could he do when it comes to Israel? Of course, the U.S. has tremendous ties to Israel, providing a massive amount of most of the weapons in Israel. If he really wanted to push Israel right now, after all, his negotiator, Witkoff, has just arrived in Israel, supposedly to jumpstart the so-called peace talks.
Well, there is this American perception that Netanyahu and Trump are very close allies and they love each other a lot. In Israeli media, which I read daily, you have a clear picture that Netanyahu and the Israeli government are terrified of Trump. They don't want to anger him. That's why as soon as Trump walked into office, Netanyahu immediately accepted the ceasefire proposal that's been on the table for 7 months or 6 months prior to Trump assuming office. He accepted immediately a temporary pause in Gaza, and then he tried to wiggle his way out of it. It's the same that you saw with Trump as soon as he wrote a single tweet telling Netanyahu, lay down your arms, stop bombing Iran. The ceasefire was instated immediately. And it's the same kind of pressure. All it would take is a single phone call from the Trump White House to Netanyahu and his government and saying, end the genocide in Gaza. But up until now, by the White House's own admission in Axios, Barak Ravid has been reporting on this, you see a consistency in the Trump White House of never trying to pressure Netanyahu at all on Gaza. At most, what they do is to tell him, the war is bad for you. You get to do whatever you want. We will keep giving you weapons and political cover and immunity. It's just not very good for your health. You make the right choice. And that is far from bringing the genocide to an end. The only thing it would take is Trump making a phone call to Netanyahu and saying, end this now. And that's something that Netanyahu is terrified about. Every time you see Trump making a statement that there is a breakthrough in the ceasefire negotiations in Gaza, you see Netanyahu taking a step back and allowing the Israeli team to go to Doha, to Qatar, and negotiate with Hamas until he bores Trump in the details and tires him mentally. And then the Israeli team is taken back, the blame is put on Hamas, and the genocide continues. It's the same dynamic over and over.
So, Mohammed, I just want to go to the comments that Trump made that perhaps were the most harsh, in a way, about the distance that he has, the position, his position, compared to Netanyahu's position. He responded to questions about starvation in Gaza while speaking to reporters on Air Force One earlier this week on Tuesday.
I think everybody, unless they're pretty cold-hearted or worse than that, nuts. There's nothing you can say other than it's terrible when you see the kids, and those are kids, you know, whether they talk starvation or not, those are kids that are starving. They are starving. And you see the mothers, they love them so much, and there's just nothing they seem to be able to do. They got to get them food, and we're going to get them food.
So, Mohammed, if you could respond very quickly to what Trump said and the fact that you've said a two-state solution, the conversation is basically dead in Israel. So what are they saying in the media there?
Well, basically, the Israeli fantasy is that Gazans are going to be pushed out and the West Bank would be next. Israel already started this process in Jenin and Tolkarem, over 42,000 people displaced already there. So they think they can start it in Gaza and then replicate it in the rest of the Palestinian territory. But with hunger and Israeli propaganda about this, you see a pattern of Israeli propaganda going to the utmost extremes. Like with the GHF massacres, we saw it with our own eyes and ears on camera. We saw witness testimonies, Red Cross statements, Doctors Without Borders statements. And the Israeli talking point was it never happened. Not just trying to minimize it, but to deny it altogether. And Israeli propaganda at this point, it does not aim to make the case for Israel or persuade you of what is right, but it's rather to sow confusion, flood the zone with as much confusion as possible, to tire people out mentally, drain them and push them away from the topic under the pretext of, oh, it's too complicated to follow up on this. What you see with Trump is basically we've reached to a point of incontrovertible conclusive evidence of mass famine in Gaza, that you have the most notorious Republican pro-Israeli lawmakers that are admitting there is starvation happening there. So it reached the point of impossible deniability, but Israel is still at the point of saying, no, it's not happening. Don't believe your lying ears and eyes.
Mohammed Shahadawi, thank you so much for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza in Copenhagen, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up next, as Trump's tariff deadline looms, August 1st, where do things stand on trade agreements? Stay with us.
Kiss me once, oh, kiss me twice. Give me a taste of paradise. I don't need the blues always on my shoulder. Give me a cold beer as I get older. Oh, my stars, how you are.
Stars by the late folk musician Michael Hurley in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see our interview and his music here, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
We turn now to trade. President Trump is standing by his August 1st deadline for trading partners to reach new trade agreements with the United States or face steep new country-specific tariffs. He posted on social media, quote, the August 1st deadline is the August... On a trade deal with South Korea was also announced.
We turn now to Lori Wallach. Lori Wallach is the director of Rethink Trade, part of the American Economic Liberties Project. She's a board member of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Thanks so much for joining us, Lori. I mean, there is so much happening leading up to this August 1st deadline. Can you talk about what's most significant? The trade deals that are threatened, the ones that are being torn apart, the ones that are being reached between Trump and, for example, South Korea, now saying he's reconsidering Canada because they're considering a Palestinian state. What should we understand here?
I think the biggest takeaway is that what is actually being done by the president, Donald Trump, is the opposite of what candidate Donald Trump promised to attract working class voters, which was using tariffs and trade policy to rebalance trade, to rebuild our manufacturing, to create good jobs, making the things we need to be safe here at home. None of that is what's happening. Instead, first of all, you've got total random chaos. It's on, it's off. That's actually chilling investment. So some of the factories, new factories that were being constructed under the previous administration, the construction has been chilled because businesses have no idea what next week is going to be his whim. Number two, you're seeing this horrible combination of sort of Trump's own personal flattery, grudges, whims, and kind of like the George W. Trump administration as far as these deals, which are not written down, are unclear how real they are, but to the extent he's touting them, what we know about them is that, for instance, the big demands, the priorities are for big tech to get rid of other countries' anti-monopoly rules or privacy policies, for big pharma to raise medicine prices, for big oil to buy more U.S. carbon-based fuels. Meanwhile, on the actual trade front, we see the administration actually starting to cave in on the pre-existing Biden-era trade policies on China, because Trump so wants to have actually a summit meeting with the president of China and be flattered there. And then the places he is putting in tariffs, you mentioned this, the tariffs on Brazil actually went into effect yesterday. The highest tariffs we have, 50%. Why? Brazil, we have a trade surplus with. We export more stuff to them than we buy. This is not the country you'd want to be hitting with trade sanctions if you're trying to balance trade and build manufacturing. No, it's for what you said. Because President Trump sees failed couster Jair Bolsonaro, the former president, getting some justice in the courts and wants to beat on what could happen to him in the future, for instance. Or you heard a big announcement about new trade deals with the Europeans, with Japan, with Korea. That would roll back existing tariffs of 25% on imported vehicles, vehicles that we do know have a very low-wage supply chain. Each of those countries' other supply chain partners have low wages, Bulgaria for Europe, Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam for Japan, etc. Instead of conditioning, dropping tariffs from the existing, we have 25% tariffs, and some of this was during Biden, on imported autos. They drop them to 15%. Bad for domestic auto production, extract no higher wages, no labor rights. And here's the kicker, Amy, they have actually 25% tariffs on imported cars from North America, the one agreement that has enforceable labor standards.
Well, let's go, in fact, to the statement that the United Auto Workers released after the U.S. trade deal with Japan was announced. In a strongly worded statement, they wrote, quote, the UAW is deeply angered by the Trump administration's announced trade deal with Japan. What we've seen so far makes one thing clear. American workers are once again being left behind. They go on to say, quote, this deal hands a win to transnational automakers that rely on low road labor practices, substandard wages, excessive temps, and union busting. We need trade deals that raise standards, not reward the race to the bottom. This deal does the opposite, the UAW wrote. So if you could respond to that, Lori, and also I want to ask you about the piece that you wrote earlier this year for the American Prospect, in which you talked about the trade deals that we need. If you could say something about that.
So the UAW is spot on right, and they were reacting particularly to the trade agreement announced with Japan, but the exact same terms have just been hatched with the European Union and also with Korea. Those three trading partners are, they comprise the vast majority of what is an enormous U.S. trade deficit in automobiles and auto parts. So that actually is an area where there is a legitimate trade action under statute called Section 232 to try and actually fix that. So Trump has rolled that back, the existing penalty for trade cheating. And then the agreements he's made, so the UAW is spot on right. The agreements he's making is using the leverage of those tariffs that he has put in place or threatened to put in place to extract goodies for the usual Republican big corporate constituencies that has nothing to do with rebuilding jobs here or rebuilding our resilience by strengthening our manufacturing sector. And in the article that you can see in the American Prospect or on our website, rethinktrade.org, where we also have a tool that folks at home can use to test each of these agreements, where we basically have an assessor, an evaluator, so you can see here are the things that would be in a good agreement. These are things we need. This would help manufacturing, help balance trade, help U.S. workers, help workers around the world, versus here is stuff that is not in our interest, by the way. Cheat. The stuff that's not in our interest has been the center of these agreements. What we need is trade policy being used in combination with other industrial policies so that we do need to rebalance trade. We have a $1 trillion trade deficit, as is a prediction of economic theory that has deindustrialized us. We can't make, as we saw during COVID, the basic things we need just to keep our families safe. In an era of climate chaos, we can't have everything made one place and schlepped across the world dumping carbon fuels. We need to diversify and have redundancy in production. All of those are policies that trade and tariffs can be a part of, but a lot of other tools have to be put in place to actually get the outcomes that you want. And what the Trump administration is doing, basically, is an abuse of the tariff tool. It's not using it for the kind of outcomes that could be strategic, but then using tariffs to threaten countries based on foreign policy, whims based on a particular flattery goal.
Trump keeps saying, we're imposing this tariff on another country, what, 50% Brazil, whatever. Who actually pays? He suggests it's the country that's going to pay. But in fact, isn't it a tax on American consumers? And also talk about small businesses in this country right now falling apart.
Okay, so here is the thing about the tariffs, which is it is the case that who pays is typically negotiated. So the neoliberal line of it's just a tax, it always gets passed on the consumers, is not right. Trump's line of the other country's paying is not right. The true answer is it depends. And what the data is showing, Amy, from the beginning of the imposition of these tariffs, is that right now a lot of the foreign companies, to try and keep the U.S. business, because we do have a $1 trillion trade deficit, the whole world is overly reliant on dumping their stuff in this country, a lot of the other countries' companies are actually either splitting the costs with the U.S. companies or are eating the costs to be able to keep the market. So we have seen some real price gouging, where U.S. companies are raising prices. But in a lot of those instances, the actual price of the tariff, the cost, has already been absorbed by the company that's selling the stuff. So the U.S. companies are price gouging and ripping us off, but they're not necessarily doing that to pay for the tariff. So it depends on what the negotiated outcome is. Practically, the tariff is paid when it comes to the U.S. It goes into the U.S. Treasury. But who actually foots that bill is negotiated, and so far it's been a lot of the companies in the other countries. It's never the other governments, though. Trump is wrong about that. And as far as, you know, what—
We have 20 seconds.
As far as what we ought to do going forward, so Trump is not using trade policy in a way to help American workers to raise standards. That needs to be the goal. What we need to do is actually track the actual outcomes and hold him accountable, because politically it's super important. And again, our website at Rethink Trade has an evaluator everyone can use to test these agreements as they come out.
Lori Wallach, director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project, board member of Citizens Trade Campaign, host of Rethinking Trade podcast. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.